Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
There's a crispness in the air and a sense of excitement. The cooling air lets us, maybe even forces us, to walk a little faster, look forward to change. Yes, it's that time again. Time to vote.
Hi, I'm Rosario Dawson. 20 million women didn't vote in the last presidential election. Unmarried women, single women, women on their own. But together, we can make a difference on issues like healthcare, job security, the environment, war, and peace. 20 million women. We have the power if we choose to use it. Join me November 7th and vote.
Sponsored by Women's Voices, Women Vote, a nonpartisan organization that does not support or oppose any candidates.
This election will go down in the history books. Record numbers of voters are expected, and the results will break barriers. Passions run deep. Adrenaline flows and energizes. We're ready for a win, and we know that winter is coming. It's a time to hunker down and rest. We don't want to go into the dark of winter as a loser. Wintering over is better with the contentedness that comes with success. So vote. That's part of the message today. Vote. You'll hear it more than once in this hour. The season brings other events, too. Halloween and Dia de los Muertos open the season. Time changes. Thanksgiving is coming. So taking a fairly broad view today, we're going to cover some topics connected by the season. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, featuring women's voices and women's stories. And today's theme is current events. We'll spend most of the show on the election with a sprinkling of other events. We're going to start with the most important events, birthdays. We begin with a birthday song for my sister Susan and for Donna, too.
You say it's your birthday. It's my birthday, too, yeah. Say it's your birthday, we're gonna have a good time. I'm glad it's your birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, Susan and Donna and everyone else who needs their birthday wishes sent out to them. Yin Radio's Anna Maria Roque writes a column for the University of Idaho's student paper, The Argonaut. She focuses on women's issues, women's interests, and women's views. Anna Maria starts off today's show with her insights into what women really want in this election and what women find most important.
What women really want. This presidential election made it very clear that women want more than just the female in power. They care about the issues. With Election Day mere days away, let's look at what women really want out of politics and where the candidates stand on those issues. Women not only make up the majority in the U.S. population, they also made up 54% of the voters in the 2004 elections. Therefore, what they want out of politics is very important. Authors Celinda Lake and Kellyanne Conway found that while women are not a monolithic group, on important political issues, they share a remarkable agreement and came up with the HERS agenda: health, education, retirement, and security. These issues, debated by the candidates in the terms of healthcare, family economics, social security, and homeland security is what will be on women's minds come Tuesday. Ann Storer volunteers her time at the Leda County Democrat's office. She's a nurse and a single mother of three sons. She said that she's currently in between jobs right now, so she spends her time supporting the Democrats because this is an important election, both at a local and national level. The decisions these people make, she said, are going to affect your life. We live in a democracy. It is important to exercise your rights. She said, we women fought hard for these rights and should use them. As a nurse and biologist, environmental problems are very important to her, as is healthcare. In general, what women want, she said, is affordable healthcare and equal pay. Equity is still a major issue for women in the workforce. And as long as women still make 77 cents to a man's dollar, this will remain a big issue. John McCain opposed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which would make it easier for women to sue their employers for pay discrimination, and serves as a progressive step in helping women achieve pay equity. Barack Obama said the problem is some employers aren't paying women enough, and many women aren't able to challenge that. The solution, he said, is to finally close the gap and pay women what they've earned and nothing less. Storer said that Republicans propose that we buy into the health care congressmen currently have. But our taxes aren't paying for their health care, she said. A lot of women with children and single moms can't afford the health care. In fact, a quarter of the nation's mothers are single women, 21% of which live below poverty lines. Health care, especially if not offered through their employer, is a luxury when you can barely make payments for your house, your car, etc. Nearly half of women voters said health care is one of the top two political issues, compared to only 3 in 10 men. Health care may very well be the most discussed topic these elections, next to perhaps the economy, and both parties promised to reform health care in order to make health care more affordable and accessible. John McCain's main proposal focuses on tax credits, so people can shop for their own. Barack Obama's plan focuses on a new national health plan, which would be guaranteed to everyone who wants it. And for many women, contraceptives fall under health care. The McCain-Palin campaign might be all about family values, but their family planning voting record is ultra-conservative, going from supporting abstinence-only education, charging victims for their own rape kits, and opposing abortion even in cases of rape and incest. McCain voted against requiring health insurance companies to provide the same level of coverage for contraception as they do for other prescription drugs. McCain has even supported limiting access to contraceptives. For women, security and health care meet in cases of sexual assault and rape. Obama passed a law requiring that emergency medical services for sexual assault survivors include coverage for emergency contraception. Obama was also the chief co-sponsor of a bill requiring that hospitals that have emergency services for sexual assault victims provide medically accurate information about emergency contraception. Joe Biden authored and passed the Violence Against Women's Act, also known as the VAWA, which criminalizes domestic violence and holds batteries accountable. The Violence Against Women's Act provides funds to help communities, nonprofit organizations, and police combat domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. Obama said that if elected, he will fully fund and implement the Violence Against Women Act. While Obama fully supports upholding Roe v. Wade, McCain believes that the abortion law was decided incorrectly and is in favor of a constitutional amendment to ban all abortion. As a mother of three sons, Ann Storer said that she strongly opposes the war. I'm a pacifist, she said. I don't want my sons to go to war. Especially not in an illegal war. While Obama intends to responsibly end the war immediately upon taking office, McCain, like the current administration, is committed to continuing the war in Iraq, stating that he is willing to stay for 100 years, regardless of the increasing regional threats and the escalating financial and human costs. The Republicans might have a woman VP candidate, but stance on these women's issues hit home for many women, and this will be in their minds come Tuesday.
That's Anna Maria Roque, Yin Radio, and, of course, at the University of Idaho's student paper, The Argonaut. Installment number 2 on this Yin Radio show of current events. Women in the political spotlight. It's a new development in the United States, something the media is still learning how to deal with. The University of Idaho's Women's Center brought together three panelists to talk about women in American politics and how the media portrays them. They explored women's issues, just what women's issues are, and if women would represent these issues better than men do, and just how many women it takes to adequately represent these issues. On the panel were Dr. Sandra Reinecke, faculty member in the Political Science and Women's Studies programs at UI, Leotina Hormel, a professor in the Sociology Department, and Ray Gasser, director of University Housing. Sandra Reinecke starts off the discussion with some statistical background on women in U.S. politics.
Statistics on female political representation in the United States look grim. And I brought along some statistics in case we want to look it up. But if the United States is so far down in terms of women's representation in elected offices, who do you think is the country in the world that has the highest representation of women in its elected office? I'm sorry?
Finland.
Did you say Finland? Finland is probably number three. The first one is Rwanda. Oftentimes, we just apply these stereotypical ideas about how the world is run and what it looks like. And when you look at a map, for instance, that tells you in terms of shades who runs a country, sometimes we are surprised, for instance, surprised by the small amount of women who are involved in politics in the United States. Overall, in the United States, we have a representation of about 35%. In Sweden, it's 45, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But if we need statistics, for instance, I have a list of women who ever ran for president and vice president. It's longer than you think. It has, I would say about 10 or 12 ladies on it, rather than just three that you probably could remember. So the issue here is the challenge that women face in order to become elected into representative office. And I wanted to propose three angles how to understand this. The first is, why don't we have more women in elected office? Are they not voting, or are they not even there? So we have, of course, the majority of U.S. citizens are women. The majority of voters are women. Women tend to vote in higher numbers than men. We have, in the 2000 election, we had 61% women participating and 58% men turning out to cast their vote. Women, on the other hand, contribute less to campaigns, and they contribute less dollars to campaigns as well. But they turn out in higher percentages to cast their ballot. However, women do tend to vote for the left party. And why do you think that is?
Social issues such as welfare reform, healthcare, and abortion rights.
And to add to it, socioeconomic status. Women make less money than men, generally, so they tend to favor, in this country, the Democratic Party. So here you, if you do your math, more women, more women voters, more left-leaning women should give you an idea of how this election comes out. Apparently, it's still a puzzle. We talk about political representation. Once we looked at political participation, we look at political representation. So the question that everybody asks is, do women have a particular interest that they want their representative towards, for instance, the social issues that you just mentioned? And if women have a woman issue, would women represent these issues better, for instance, in Congress or in the Senate or as a president and so forth? Okay. And then, of course, if women actually were to represent women's issues better, how many of them do you have in order to achieve this? Do you have to have 50% of them, or 68, or 79.5? So these are the kind of questions that political scientists ask themselves. Does mass matter? Do we have to have a critical mass of female representatives in order to change policy? Because just the liking for a candidate and voting for her does not necessarily make a policy change. So we wonder, if we need more women, what's the critical mass that we need in order to change policy? And what is in disfavor of women representation in elected office is, for instance, the electoral system in the countries that we're looking at. In the United States, you have what we call a single district electoral system. The winner takes all. And so parties are more reluctant to put a woman in there because the assumption is that she's not able to win over the male candidate, then you're losing the entire district. Whereas countries such as Sweden, Finland, and so forth, who have a higher representation of women in elected office, they have a multiple district electoral system. Don't blame it on men, blame it on the electoral system. Of course, everybody has to work together in order to change the electoral system, but it really is an important point. So keep in mind, even if we have women on the ballot, if we have an electoral system where the winner takes all, it is harder for women to be nominated, to be on the ballot for the district. Countries like France, for instance, who also tend to have a lower number of women in elected positions because of their electoral system, what they've done, they've changed the constitution. Boom, they said, you know, we are done with gender inequality, we're making it gender parity. So since 2001, the French constitution was changed, and since 2001, all political parties in France are required to put an equal number of men and women on their ballots. So there you go, the French. Do it before anybody else. So did it work? It didn't work. The parties don't do this, they have to pay a fine. So the parties say, okay, we'll go and pay the fine. Because we still don't want to lose to a man. And since they have the single district electoral system as well, they still find it too risky to really put a woman on there. You wonder, what are the odds against, for instance, having a female president or having a female vice president, or increasing the numbers of political representatives in Congress and Senate and in other elected state office? Don't forget, there's all these other offices that are really, really, really important. So just to give you an idea here, historically, the first female mayor in the United States was elected in 1887. When did women gain the right to vote in the United States?
1920.
So this is 33 years prior to on the federal level, women gaining the right to vote. On the state level, it's a little bit different. The first female state legislator got into office was elected in 1894, and the first state senator from Utah was elected in 1896. By 2003, 22% of all state legislators were female. 22% of all state legislators. That's since 1896. That's more than 100 years later. You have from 0.01% to 22%. That's whooping. Your first female congresswoman was elected from Montana in 1917. That's 3 years before women gained the right to vote. In 2003, female representatives 13.6. Now keep in mind, the majority of the population in the United States is female. The first female governor, since we have a female governor being on the ticket for vice president, was elected in 1925. Again, blame it on the electoral system. And unfortunately, also there is a misperception that voters have to vote either on gender or on issues. That's a completely absurd question. No male or female voter would ever ask herself, well, should I vote for Senator Obama based on him being a male or what he thinks about the economy, right? That's completely absurd. I'll leave it at that. And
Leontina Hormel comes from an economic sociology perspective. She shares her thoughts about Sarah Palin and the way she has been framed by both the Republican Party and the media.
I'm coming from a really different angle.
I think the interesting point is that you have Western states putting women in positions of power before other states. And I've been thinking a lot about Sarah Palin. I was looking at these Newsweek. If you look up Newsweek Sarah Palin in March, there's a whole bunch of clips of her being interviewed in San Francisco by Newsweek. She actually does not sound as strange as she does when you see her in the interviews now. I think because she was able to speak candidly about where she comes from and what she does, and that she wasn't pigeonholed into trying to represent a particular type of femininity to the Republican Party potential voters. And so I really encourage people to look that up, because I do think that she's getting a bum rap in many ways that I think is connected more to the framing of the Republican Party in general and the McCain camp. What I find fascinating about the Republican campaign versus the Democratic campaign, that's how masculinities and femininities kind of shape what's going on. And a lot of those are shaped by their class backgrounds or what type of class framing they want to project, to perhaps struggle with power and things like that. And what I found fascinating with the Republican Party is how successful it is in mobilizing working class men. Palin, to me, was still consistent with the Republican Party. I don't think that she was a step away from what the Republican Party might have wanted in a woman candidate to begin with. Because if you look at them historically, they've really tried to appeal to the working class white man. And Sarah Palin is all about that. She might be what we think of as frontier masculinity. She is the woman who would be married to the frontier masculine model, which is very counter to pervasive hegemonic masculinity, which is the business class. And they do really try to portray her as this person that supports that form of masculinity. And maybe they were hoping that her veneer wouldn't crack so quickly in terms of whether she's prepared for the type of barrage that you get when you're being vetted by the media and by voters and things like that. I would say that she was strategic in that sense. And if you actually allow yourself to look at who she really is, she is an interesting person. She struggles with feminism. She, in some ways, I think, does advance it. She talks about how was in sports in the early 80s in a time where women's sports was still not something supported very well in high schools, and that she, because she wasn't like a lot of men in high school who could try to get good scholarships through athletics, that's why she ended up going to the beauty queen pageant. And this is something that I think that I would like to note, is that notice how we mobilize as media, as voters. The McCain campaign even, is that what do we know most about her? We know about her hunting, but what we try to contrast that with is the fact that she was a beauty queen. And we use that to try to degrade her. And she actually, in this March 2008 discussion, said that she hates that always being the one thing that comes up about her, that she's literally introduced as a beauty queen, you know, beauty queen and things like that, where she herself doesn't really identify with that. I find Sarah Palin fascinating in trying to gauge, you know, who's the real person and who's not, and how that's been manipulated in this political scene. Thank you.
That's Leontina Hormel, sociology professor at the University of Idaho. She was one of three panelists at a recent Women Center talk, Women in Politics. Leontina also shared her insights into how masculinity and femininity play out in the political arena. Is Obama masculine enough? Who embodies the frontier masculinity more, Obama or Clinton? Here is her take on it.
And I think this is an interesting way of thinking about sexism and racism and class. You know, I like to think of all three of those and more, sexuality in general, that they're intersecting in these very interesting ways. And Obama's sexuality gets questioned in not direct ways, but in focusing on whether he's very manly and being juxtaposed. That's why it's really important to think of the Republican Party as the frontier masculinity, when really they're the business class masculinity, which no working class men would ever vote for, but but we want to be puffy-chested frontier masculinity. And that allows them to contrast someone like Obama to them. I would say that they were not happy when Obama actually got the candidacy, because Hillary was going to be an easier pick for them. And
you mean target?
Target, yes. They could pick at her and in a much easier way. And if you listen to the right-wing talk shows, I was painting for my parents, their bathroom, in March, and my dad was listening to Gordon Liddy on the radio and had Fox News blasting at the same time. He was worried I was alone in his bathroom painting. And so he had them both going, and I was like, oh, as if this environment's not toxic enough with the fake news. But at the time was when they were busy promoting Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. because they knew that her femininity would be so easy to pinpoint, again, as a classist, elitist, masculine femininity. Mm-hmm. And Obama, they knew that they could conjure him as this effeminate being, because, you know, subtly with race in there as the undertone, and also to try to make him out to be this elite person, which I think is ironic if we think of race history. And I just wanted to print out the whole debate that they had in the early August time of, is he too thin? Is he too fit to be president? They're treating him, right? Women are very used to their appearances being scrutinized. Hillary had to be very used to that. And they're treating him the same way, which I found fascinating. I haven't seen as much of that play when you deal with Clinton, for instance. I mean, who can challenge that masculinity anyway? That might actually be one up on the frontier masculinity. So I find that those things, I think you can't disregard the intersections of these different forms of inequalities in trying to represent without any fact, but to try to represent people in these different images and to mobilize working class men, and working class wives will feel inclined to follow, perhaps, and maybe that explains why, even though there's more women voting, they want to be like Sarah Palin and be supportive, and, you know, they don't, it's brutal to question that masculinity and that power system.
And last on the panel, Ray Gasser shares his view, the only male perspective on the panel, on the media's portrayal of Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin.
I come as an observer of politics. I enjoy watching politics. I enjoy watching what's going on. And having followed it for quite a few years, I think I was invited on because of that. So I've jotted down a lot of different things in terms of observations that I've made, in whether it's in regards to Sarah Palin or Hillary Clinton, or even the governor's run in Washington State right now between Christine Gregoire and Dina Rossi. In some of the things that are playing out there. In terms of Sarah Palin, I thought Sarah Palin's pick was a political decision rather than it was strategic in a sense. I don't think it's necessarily paying off like Senator McCain was hoping for in rallying some of the disenfranchised women after Hillary tied Obama right near the end of the process. But I think there's a reality that was not necessarily finding the best possible candidate. Nothing against Sarah Palin and her abilities. I think if the Republican Party was to be honest, and if candidates were to be honest, they could have identified a stronger woman if they wanted a woman for that role. But they tokenized what they were looking for. And let's be honest, Sarah Palin can be very appealing to a lot of voters out there in terms of the way she speaks. She speaks, you know, if we want to classify Obama as kind of elitist in the way he speaks and the way he talks to people, then we could probably put Palin on the other end of the spectrum in her ability to sound like a lot of people out there in the United States. I think in a lot of ways, the choice was a highly political one, but not with a lot of good political merit behind it. It was decided as a result of the fact that Obama didn't choose Hillary as his running mate, which is ironic because the Republican Party played off Hillary throughout the primaries, and then at the vetting of the VP decision, one of the strongest front runners for Obama, at least, what was Governor Kaine out of Virginia. He was a person had been in the governor's office for 2 years. See if there's any parallels here. And he was being really talked up as really energizing his state, being a real positive attribute, someone that could potentially bring Virginia to the Democrats. But at the same time, the Republican Party played off the fact that he didn't have enough experience. He very new to the scene. He'd been a mayor of a town in Virginia, bigger than Wasilla. But they literally played off. So you can look back at the history of what was going on, and here Obama did just the opposite thing that McCain did. He chose someone that was literally going to try to lend to his credibility as a presidential candidate by choosing someone that would fill in a void. I think you could say in some ways that Palin was a similar choice, in that one of the arguments against McCain was that maybe he was too old, maybe he was a little out of touch with the mainstream, So here you bring in kind of an energetic person that can speak right down. One, speak down to your base. McCain was somewhat disenfranchised from the base of the Republican Party. Here you bring someone in, energetic, very charismatic, brings the gender piece that maybe they thought, you know, they could swing some folks. And it appears at least there's some people out there that have identified that they have. As far as what polls are suggesting is that she hasn't had a lot of swing in terms of actually bringing independent-minded women over to the Republican side of the road. Almost immediately after Palin was picked, the media was doing a lot of trying to find some background. The media hadn't really vetted her as a serious candidate, which is where this pick was such a surprise to a lot of people, because anyone, regardless of your political beliefs, would say that there were probably stronger female candidates out there that he could have vetted in terms of experience, not necessarily in terms of charismatic energy, youth, whatnot. You know, you've never seen this before in presidential politics that I'm aware of, is that there's a portion of the electorate that started, you know, doing internet searches on Beauty Queen, Palin, and it became kind of sexualizing a vice presidential candidate, which I don't think anyone had been doing that for McCain or Obama or Joe Biden when he was, you know, looking up.
Statistically irrelevant.
Yeah. I think comments before about if you heard Sarah speak prior to this, even in the vetting process, I mean, it's not that she's not articulate, but she's been put into having positions on things a governor doesn't have to think about. I think the McCain campaign really hurt her. My belief is that it was almost a form of reverse sexism towards their own candidate because they shielded her from the media. And so the media got hungrier and hungrier. I can share that University Housing has been contacted several times by the New York Times, the LA Times, lots of national media to find out any little bit of information, including, you know, the story came out pretty soon afterwards that she lived in the tower, Theopolis Tower. Well, they wanted to know who her RA was. No, like every bit of information that they could find out about her. Exactly. So to me, I think you really have to look at what the McCain campaign has done to hurt Palin's ability to be a credible, seen as a mainstream credible candidate because of the way they shielded her. In terms of reversing roles, you also have to look at how the Republican Party has when Hillary was in the primaries. While I agree that I think they did want to see Hillary be the successful candidate, and I think the Republican Party even tried to help her in some ways, there was also points where the Republican Party or conservatives would go after her, and this has been true since she came in as a first lady in '92. She was seen as too strong a first lady. Now, an interesting thing is being proposed, you know, what do we know about Todd Palin? You know, what role is he going to play? And that's something that you just have to think about reversing roles because we've seen it right in this election, which is very interesting to see Hillary go through and then the Republicans trying to build her up so that they end up being running against her. Because at the same time, they feel like they know how to also tear her down based on previous history. And then now, trying to protect Sarah Palin when she came out to say, hey, you know, the media needs to lay off of her. You know, let's not critique her because she fumbled this question. She's not used to this mainstream media. So you have to look at all the kind of double standards that are playing out in this campaign. Because we've seen it from both sides, and I will readily admit that the Democrats aren't a lot better in some of the things that they're doing as well. Sarah Palin should be a non-issue in terms of her family, her identity, but we've created a standard that family should be questioned. The fact that she has five children, can she handle all this? It would be a question that's never been asked to a large extent of a male candidate for president. And yet that's coming up, and it continues to come up. And that's where I really think that those should be questions that should be left to individual voters rather than to the mainstream media, rather than to the opposing parties.
That was Ray Gasser wrapping up our report from the UI Women's Center panel called Women in Politics. The report was by Ana Maria Roque. Women's Voices, Women's Stories on Yin Radio. Today's theme is current events. Up next, some announcements take a very titillating approach to get the attention of their listeners.
I was the last one of all my friends to do it. After I did it my first time, I told everybody. I had such a big mouth about it. You got all that energy flowing inside, and you go in and commit.
20 million women didn't vote in the last presidential election. This November 7th, do something really important for your country. Vote.
It's a beautiful thing.
Sponsored by Women's Voices, Women Vote, a nonpartisan organization that does not support or oppose any candidates.
Installment number 3, around town in Moscow, Idaho, Yin Radio's Ana Maria Roque asked people about a non-election topic.
Have you ever wanted to watch a scary movie without the sound? It would be a lot less scary without the eerie, dreadful music indicating what is to come. In the spirit of Halloween, I did an around town with the question, what is the scariest movie theme song or sound? And here are the answers that I got.
Okay, Goosebumps is a TV show, not a movie, but I still think it's the scariest because Poser managed to make it really chilling, I think. I never read the books, I actually never even saw the very many episodes of the, but I do remember the theme music.
Scariest movie theme song.
Jaws. I was 7. Oh my god. Because you knew it was coming. And the music came on. Yeah, I was a little scary.
I never watched scary movies. I have no idea. No clue.
So, the only one I can really think of that's really scary that I always thought was scary is the Friday the 13th Jason theme. It's like that every time I'm driven anywhere in Idaho, I think that someone's going to jump out of the bush and that song's going to play in the back of my mind.
What's the scariest theme song you can think of?
When Simba's in the tree on The Lion King, yeah, and the antelope are chasing him, and he's up in the tree, and then his dad gets trampled.
It still scares you?
Yeah.
The theme song to Friday the 13th.
Why is it scary?
Yeah, it's really loud.
Because
it's just
you know he's coming.
I think the Halloween movie theme song with the eerie piano.
I don't know, I like Halloween the best.
This isn't a theme song, but that sound and the grudge.
The grudge is really scary.
The grudge will haunt me forever.
Yeah, I have to say the grudge theme song is serious.
Probably Jaws, because it's the only theme song that I know from scary movies.
Oh man, I would have to say Friday the 13th.
What's the scariest movie theme song?
That Exorcist sound, the eek 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 eek. That one.
Yeah. Is it still scary today?
Yeah, I think it's creepy. But Exorcist, for sure.
Now back to politics, and the presidential politics in particular, for our last installment. It's called Political Wonder Women. Women have been running for president of the United States for more than 100 years. Yes, that's right. Hillary's not the first. When it comes to U.S. presidential leaders, many other women have logged firsts, starting with Victoria Woodhull. She ran for president in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket. Yes, that's 1872. She lost to a fellow Ohioan, Ulysses S. Grant. 12 years later, Bell the Lockwood ran for president in 1884 and again in 1888. From then on, the late 1800s until 1960, only one other woman was proposed as presidential candidate, and that was Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman for president ran across the front of a 1943 Marvel comic book. But it also said in the small print that this was Wonder Woman 1,000 years in the future. But it wasn't until the 1960s that the presidential attempts by women picked up. After a number of women served in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate in state legislatures, as governors and as mayors. 1960, Whitney H. Slocum ran for president under the Greenback Party. Then in 1964, Margaret Chase Smith ran. She was a Republican, member of the House of Representatives from 1940 to 49, and senator from 49 to 1973. But in 64, she was presidential candidate in the primary elections. In 1968, Charlene Mitchell. But then in 1972, things really picked up for women with four, count them, four female presidential candidates. Patsy Takamoto Mink, Bella Savitsky Abzug, Bella Abzug, Linda Osteen Jenness, and the renowned Shirley Anita St. Hill Chisholm. Shirley Chisholm was the first female black member of the House of Representatives, and she served 14 years from 1968 through 82. She was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination at the Democratic Party convention. Here she is at the convention.
I will not camouflage or support the forces that wish this country to become an undemocratic influence in the community of the world of nations. Here at home, I will tell the truth about the poverty and hardships suffered by so many of our citizens, not just the minority or jobless group traditionally thought of as poor and deprived, but the working poor as well, the millions of men and women who work hard and constantly, but still cannot make enough to decently clothe, house, and feed themselves and their families. I will tell the truth about the visible differences of race and sex that have been used to isolate women of all racial groups and minority men as an unpaid or underpaid source of labor, whether they are working in factories or fields, in their own kitchens or other people's kitchens, in office buildings or in government agencies and on college campuses. I will tell the truth about the big corporations, the defense industries, the utilities, the railroads, the airlines, and the agribusiness powers that are the true welfare recipients. The taxpayer spends far more for these corporate subsidies than she or he does for the so-called welfare recipient, the individual who simply cannot get the training or opportunity necessary to support themselves and their families.
Now, after Shirley Chisholm ran, more female candidates continued to seek the U.S. presidency. 1976, Margaret Wright and Ellen McCormick. Ellen McCormick, by the way, was the first woman to receive matching funds. She appeared on the ballot in 18 states and received a total of 267,590 votes in the primaries, and 22 votes from delegates at the Democratic National Convention. And she engaged in a debate with President Jimmy Carter. In 1980, Ellen McCormick ran again and was joined in the race by Deirdre Griswold and Maureen Smith. In 1984, even more, Sonia Johnson with running mate Emma Wong Marr. And Isabel Masters, who didn't give up, she ran again in 1992, 96, 2000, and 2004. Gabrielle Holmes with running mate Gloria E. La Rivera. And in 1984, also Patricia Scott Schroeder. Congresswoman Pat Schroeder was Democratic candidate for the nomination in the primary elections, but she did withdraw from the race before the party convention. The first Democratic woman to actually appear on the ballot paper was Geraldine Ferraro, who was vice presidential candidate in 1984 as Walter Mondale's running mate. They lost to Ronald Reagan, but the fervor over her candidacy was great. Here's Geraldine Ferraro at the Democratic Convention.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro. tonight. America is a land where dreams can come true for all of us. As I stand before the American people and think of the honor this great convention has bestowed upon me, I recall the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who made America stronger by making America more free. He said, "Occasionally in life, there are moments which cannot be completely explained by words. Their meaning can only be articulated by the inaudible language of the heart. Tonight is such a moment for me. My heart is filled with pride. My fellow citizens, I proudly accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
Geraldine Ferraro and Pat Schroeder generated excitement. Serious women candidates. Yet after the fervor and the losses, things slowed down for women seeking that highest office. The ranks of senator, congresswomen, governors, and state representatives and mayors were growing, however, slow and steady. And this probably fed the growth that was seen among presidential female candidates three elections later. In 1988, we only had two. In 1992, Gloria La Rivera, Susan Block, Helen Betty Halyard, and Millie Howard. 1996 set records for women candidates. I counted 11, if I got it right. In the year 2000, Elizabeth Hanford Dole led the women candidates, all 12 of them. She had served as assistant to the president for public liaison, secretary of transportation, and secretary of labor. Her husband, former Senator Bob Dole, was the Republican presidential candidate in 96. 4 years later, Elizabeth Dole ran, but she did withdraw from the Republican convention because of lack of funding. In 2002, she was elected senator for North Carolina. Also in the running in 2000, among some 200 candidates who had registered for presidential elections in one or more states, were Kathy Gordon Brown with VP running mate Sabrina R. Allen, Temperance Alicia Lance Council, Paula E. Bennett, Deborah Katz Puschel, Angel Joy Rocker, Dorian Yeager, Rachel One Family Miller, Raj Allison Officewala, Gloria Dawn Strickland, Linda D. Blodgett, Sandra S. Duffy, Johanna Joan Malone. Johanna Joan Malone ran again in 2004, along with a large group of female candidates. And that group of 2004 was Mildred Williams Glover, Janine Shabib, Georgia Howe, Melanie Pridgen, Diana Ramsey Rasmussen Kennedy IV, Deborah Elaine Allen, Joy Elena Graham Pendergast,
Jackie Hayward, Deborah Joyce Renderos, Nancy Warrick, and a name you might recognize, Carol Moseley Braun, the first African-American woman to serve in the U.S. Senate and former ambassador to New Zealand, a country which, by the way, has a female prime minister currently, the Right Honorable Helen Clark. Here's a portion of Carol Moseley Braun's stump speech from August 2003. It sounds like something that could be used today.
We've gone since 9/11 in a situation in which some folks have figured out that if they pander to our fear, they can push an extreme right-wing agenda, not only here, but abroad. What was supposed to have been a war on terrorism turned into a misadventure, just running out, you know, in Iraq, doing whatever. I mean, we still, think about it. When was the last time you heard Bin Laden's name? Think of who? Ben who? Been missing. Our young men and women put in harm's way for no real rational reason. And now, and even though the aircraft carrier and the war is supposed to be over, we're still hearing horrible reports coming back. All those people, you know, remember old Europe? And the people we thumbed our noses at? Now we're saying, well, maybe we do need you all's help after all. Well, you know, this is no way to interface and interact with the rest of the world. At a time when the challenges facing us are global in nature, we can't solve SARS and AIDS and poverty and globalization going it by ourselves, tell them to bring it on. We've got to work well with others. We've got to work with the rest of the world and the leadership of the rest of the world to raise up those values that made this the greatest country and that make us proud to be Americans. 2004 will be a time for us to make a decision. What path will we go down? Will we continue to let the fear mongers and the hate mongers and the people who divide and who pick fights dominate our politics and direct our direction into the next century? Or will we choose to embrace that which is best about this country, build community, and engage with the rest of the world in behalf of a future that we'll be proud to have left in our time? That's the issue. And that is why I've stepped forward to run for President of the United States. This is a very serious candidacy and a very serious campaign. As you've heard from the introduction, I am as credentialed as any of the fellas and more than most.
Each year, there are fewer and fewer first steps available thanks to these women. Each woman to run stands on the shoulders of her predecessors and gets higher and higher each time. And each one breaks new boundaries. Each one is a Wonder Woman.
This year, there are 20 million reasons to register and vote.
They are doctors, nurses, teachers, and students.
Artists, photographers, waitresses, and bloggers.
They are firefighters, policewomen, athletes.
They are Iraq War veterans and single mothers.
Some are rocket scientists, even magicians.
Some have voted for a long time. Some are voting for the first time.
20 million haven't been voting at all. But this year,
we can change that. Women's Voices, Women Vote is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that doesn't endorse any candidates.
To register, go to wvwv.org.
I'm glad you could join me for this Yin Radio program on current events. To end the show, here's Heidi Muller with November.
November is that month between Turkey Day and Halloween. Jack-o'-lanterns lose their teeth when November comes to call. High school football's going strong. Sunny days don't last too long. Coats and sweaters hold their breath as we hold on to fall. Blue sky gone gray, snap in the air. Cold feet, wool socks, long underwear. November is that time of year for flannel shirts and homemade beer, leather gloves and bamboo rakes, and cleaning up the yard. Summer birds are often flown halfway to their vacation homes. Up in the mountains, bears all know a change is in the cards. Blue sky gone gray, snap in the air. Cold feet, wool socks, long
You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Y-I-N Radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. You can catch past shows and sign up for podcasts at www.yinradio.org. For today's show, thanks to Anna Maria Roque, Sandra Reinecke, Leontina Hormel, Ray Gasser, and all the women who vote and who run for office. All the pieces for today's show were produced by Anna Maria Roque, with the exception of Political Wonder Women, which was produced by Sandy Billings. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings. Until next week.
No more leaves to break our fall down winter's icy hill. Blue sky gone gray, snap in the air. Turkey Day and Halloween. Jack-o'-lanterns lose their teeth when November comes to call. Jack-o'-lanterns lose their teeth when November comes to call.